Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. There was a time in America when millions of people were sickened by measles, and something like 500 people actually died as a result of measles every year. A vaccine that was introduced in the early 60s virtually eliminated measles, but now the disease seems to be making a comeback, helped in part by the growing number of parents who are choosing not to have their children immunized. And there is concern that we might see the resurgence of other diseases that have virtually been eliminated for the same reason, because people are not having their kids go to the doctor and get their shots. This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Dr. Paul Offit. He's professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania. We'll talk a little bit about some of these concerns about vaccine safety and also why it really matters that children do indeed get these shots. And of course, questions from people who are listening are welcome. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. He is a pediatrician who specializes in infectious disease medicine and also an internationally known expert on vaccines. He's professor of pediatrics at University of Pennsylvania. He's chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He's authored a number of books, among them Vaccines, What You Should Know, The Cutter Incident, How America's First Polio Vaccine Led to Today's Growing Vaccine Crisis. That was published in 2005, and we talked about that book here on this program. And also his one of his other books is called Vaccinated, One Man's Quest to Defeat the World's Deadliest Diseases. That was just published last year, and it is all about a man named Maurice Hilleman, who was directly involved in the development of most of the vaccines that are available today, including those for measles, mumps, rubella, hepatitis A and B, and Haemophilus influenza B. So you can look for the books out in the bookstore in the library. And as we talk, of course, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, certainly you're welcome to call. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that people just try to keep their questions brief so we can keep moving along here. But people who are listening, you're certainly welcome to call. Dr. Offit, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Just generally speaking, before maybe talking about some specifics, and maybe we can talk about measles, for example, just as a kind of case study, but just generally speaking, what has been the benefit of the availability of vaccines for the kind of diseases like those that I mentioned, measles, mumps, rubella, hepatitis, and so forth?
Right. Well, if you look, it's a century ago, in 1900, we had one vaccine, which was the smallpox vaccine. And I mean, today children receive, 14 vaccines to protect against 14 different diseases. And during that 100-year period, our lifespan has increased by about 30 years. And most of that increase was actually directly due to vaccines. So that's what vaccines have done. They've helped us live longer.
Mm-hmm. Just to talk specifically about measles, because there have been some stories about this recently, it appears that have now gone from something where perhaps we can't say it was truly eradicated, but the concern was that maybe if somebody got measles in the United States, it's because it came in from outside of the United States, that we'd done a pretty good job with dealing with measles here. And at the same time, though, within the last couple of years, the numbers have been starting to come up. Has that been a significant increase?
I think the answer to that's probably no. I mean, if you look at certainly prior to the vaccine first being introduced in this country, which was in 1963, we had, as you mentioned in the prelude here, at least 100,000 children who were hospitalized every year, and probably sort of thousands who were killed by that disease. Then we got very good about immunizing, but then we didn't get so good about immunizing really in the late 70s. And we had, with about 70% immunization rates, we had started to see outbreaks. And those outbreaks accounted for tens of thousands of hospitalizations, about 120 deaths. And so then we got much better actually at mandating vaccines. That was really, in many ways, the birth of at least enforcing vaccine mandates. And with that, we dramatically lowered the incidence of measles so that we would have certainly typically less than 50 cases a year. I mean, and frankly, in more recent years, it was close to zero. I think what we're seeing now is we're seeing an outbreak in 15 states that involves, I think right, the latest number was 127 children, one of five of whom were hospitalized, none have been killed. I think that you know, it's an outbreak. It's certainly one to consider. And if it gets to the point where hundreds of children are hospitalized, then you'll start to see some measles deaths, and that will certainly be a clarion call to doing something more. But I still think we're doing pretty good.
Well, now we've had this, which is maybe something to maybe not to be seriously worried about, but something to watch. There was within recent memory here an outbreak, again, maybe small, but significant, of mumps. Is it the case that some of these diseases that we had pretty much damped down to an extremely low level because of vaccines, have we started to see cases like this where there has been a noticeable outbreaks of these diseases?
No, I think the mumps story was still somewhat of an aberration. I mean, we did see an outbreak, and primarily involved the Midwest, so around near where you were living, and it affected about 4,000 children during that outbreak, and about 6,000 children totally that year. I think we benefit actually from a second dose of mumps vaccine, which has now been instituted, and as those children get older, I think that will eliminate that kind of problem. That actually wasn't a problem, I think, with people choosing not to get vaccinated, as compared to the measles outbreak, which clearly is. I think we are to some extent on the precipice. I do agree with that. I mean, you know, polio, for example, was eliminated in this country in 1979. But, you know, polio outbreaks still occur in Africa and Southeast Asia, India, and the Middle East. And there's no doubt, since only about one of every 200 people with polio is actually paralyzed by the disease, that people that unknowingly are shedding poliovirus probably walk into this country every year. I think if we lower immunization rates and saw again a case or two or five of polio, I think that would be really evidence that of how badly we're doing in terms of keeping our immunization rates up.
Well, then I suppose the question is, how worried should we be about the number? And maybe you should talk, to the extent that we can put a number on it, how worried should we be about parents who are choosing not to have their children immunized?
Well, I think it is worrisome. I mean, in many ways, this is probably going to surprise you, I think it's completely to be expected. You know, I think you can argue it's the natural history of an immunization program, that when we ask that children now get, you know, vaccines against 14 different diseases by 2 years of age. I mean, children can get as many as 26 inoculations in the first couple years of life and as many as 5 shots at one time. I think that asks a lot. And so that, in combination with the fact that, you know, most parents don't see vaccine-preventable disease today, and frankly, most young mothers didn't even grow up with these diseases. And so you're asking them to have faith in pharmaceutical companies, faith in public health officials, faith in their doctors at a time when I think it's a pretty cynical time. And so I think that one starts to see a fraying at the edges of that trust is not surprising. And that you see, because this is inevitable, this you can predict with 100% certainty, as you lower immunization rates, you know, diseases will occur. And although our general disease or immunization rates are good, what you're starting to see is pockets of people, you know, like as was true in San Diego and upstate New York, where less than 50% of people in a community have vaccinated their children, and that's when outbreaks occur. So do I think we should be worried? Yes. Do I think that parents, even who are vaccinating their children, should be worried that there are growing numbers who are choosing not to be vaccinated? Yes, because no vaccine is 100% effective.
Hmm. Well, just to deal with the issue that maybe parents are concerned with just the number of needle sticks that their kids get, and that maybe is they're concerned about, who knows what, just the hassle, the discomfort, the expense. There has been some suggestion that one of the things that you could do about this would be essentially to bundle the vaccines so that you could combine some of them in one shot. So that would mean fewer injections. To what extent is that feasible, and do you think that that would actually help address this concern, at least that parents some might have, about how many different inoculations their children will get?
Yeah, and you know, there have been combination vaccines like Pediarix or Pentacell, which was just recently licensed, that, you know, that have that vaccine has diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis or whooping cough, the inactivated polio vaccine and Haemophilus influenza type B, all in one vaccine. And I think that helps, but it, you know, still children are going to be receiving a fair number of shots at one time. The more worrisome stance, though, is the other one, where people say, you know, I don't want my child to get more than 2 shots at any one time, and I really want to space out or delay or separate or even withhold vaccines, then what you're doing is you're increasing the time during which children are susceptible to vaccine-preventable disease. And I think that's actually the more worrisome stance. What I try and to tell parents is that call me, and it's frequent, there are actually less immunological components in today's vaccines, today's 14 vaccines, than in the one smallpox vaccine children got 100 years ago, because we're so much better at making purer, safer vaccines. And frankly, vaccines really are a trivial challenge to the immune system compared to what one typically encounters and manages every day.
So the concern apparently for some people is that children, they're young, their immune system is not fully developed, that if you challenge it and present it with the active ingredients that are in the vaccine, that people are worried that, say, if you do that, if you give them too heavy a load of that at one time, that's going to be a problem?
Yeah, that's the perception, but it's certainly not based on fact. I mean, if you certainly, when you're in the womb, you're in a sterile environment. But when you enter the birth canal and then the world, you're not. And you very quickly have living on the surfaces of your body trillions of bacteria. I mean, literally trillions of bacteria to which you make an immune response. I mean, you'll typically make, you know, grams, I mean, sort of teaspoons worth of immunoglobulin G or so-called secretory immunoglobulin A every day just to handle the sort of the immense overload of bacteria that you encounter in food that isn't sterile and dust that you breathe in that isn't sterile. I mean, if you really want to scare yourself, I guess as a parent, you could take a cotton swab the inside of a child's nose, put it on a microscope slide, and look at it under the microscope. I mean, it's teeming with bacteria to which you make an immune response. Vaccines, although you see the vaccines, you see those shots being given, it really is a trivial challenge compared to what you're typically encountering every day.
Hmm. Our guest in this first hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Paul Offit. He is a pediatrician whose special area of practice is infectious disease medicine. He's also an internationally known expert on vaccines. He's professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania and is also chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And we're talking about vaccination and what it's all about and why people should make sure that they have their children get the recommended immunizations. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And clearly, there are some people who have some concerns about the effect of vaccines, and maybe we'll deal with that in a bit. But to address the other kind of concern, do you have some idea how many parents are choosing not to have their kids immunized or maybe just not thinking about it? And it's for one of the reasons that you cited, that is, we have done such a good job at getting rid of these diseases or dampening them down to a very low level that people don't see them now. And maybe people who are now having children, they didn't see them when they were kids. And that it's not that parents so much that parents are afraid of them, it's that they somehow just think that it's not, they don't understand that it's necessary. How much of that do you think there is?
Not a lot. I would say that probably those who are choosing not to vaccinate their children is probably about 2% of parents. So it's not a high amount. They're quite vocal. I think those who are frightened about vaccines and their what they perceive as their damaging effects are very good, I think, about getting the ear of politicians and the ear of the media. So you hear from them a great deal, but I don't think they represent a large, even a moderate percentage of parents. There have been studies done on this, and it's probably about 2%.
Mm. Well, then for people who maybe, and it's a small number of people that somehow are concerned about negative side effects or problems associated with the vaccine, certainly there was for some time concern about the mercury compound thimerosal that was used as a preservative in vaccines, which now has been gone for something like 7 or 8 years. Mm-hmm. That was sort of a concern. What is it that people are worried about, or is there something, is it not that specific what they're worried about?
No, I think, I mean, that's actually a perfectly good example. I mean, so for example, there was a concern that vaccines might cause autism, and that's been sort of floating out there for really since the early 1980s. It gained a tremendous amount of life in the late 1990s when a British researcher proposed that it was the combination measles, mumps, rubella, or MMR vaccine that caused autism, and that got a tremendous amount of play in England, and you know, people, a large percentage of parents stopped vaccinating their children with MMR, and consequently there were outbreaks of measles that caused hundreds of hospitalizations and four deaths. That notion spread to the United States, and at least 100,000 parents of 100,000 children didn't vaccinate their children with measles, which I think is at the heart of this epidemic. But again, I think public health officials stepped forward and did the right kinds of epidemiological studies, which showed that, you know, that you weren't at greater risk for autism by getting MMR. And then it kind of morphed to hypothesis two, which was that this thimerosal, mercury-containing preservative in vaccines, caused autism. And again, there were six studies in this case that have been done. There's two more that'll be coming up in the next year or so that, again, showed no relationship between, you know, receipt of thimerosal-containing vaccines or autism. And now we're kind of morphed, I think, to hypothesis three, which is a much more loosely definable one, and I think, frankly, much more difficult to test, which is that children are just getting too many vaccines too soon. But again, it's this, you know, we just keep moving from one hypothesis to the next. I think what's a little upsetting to me is that people sometimes don't believe the science, that even when, you know, scientific studies exonerate vaccines as a cause of autism, they still hold on to this notion, much as one holds a religious belief, just kind of unshakable.
Well, is that ultimately an education problem? And is this something that that pediatricians can do something about? Or is it that you're swimming upstream against a media that just simply likes that kind of story?
We're swimming upstream against the media that likes that kind of story. You know, it's the notion that vaccines are safe and effective, I don't think sells much advertising. The notion that they may be causing things that are hurting your children is much more exciting, even if it's wrong. I mean, I think that what happens is when those studies come out, they don't get much media play. Yet, you know, individuals who propose this to be true get a lot of media play. It's very hard. And so I just think you know, as scientists or physicians, you just have to hang in there and keep trying to pound away, you know, at the media to say that this isn't true. But it is, as you say, swimming upstream.
Yeah. Now, I suppose you also would have to say that that nothing in medicine is perfect. Are there, as a result of vaccinations, what level of bad outcomes are there?
Well, I mean, you're right. I think anything that you put into your body, including vaccines, that has an effect, in this case, protecting against vaccine-preventable diseases, will have a side effect. And vaccines, you know, like commonly cause pain or redness or tenderness at the site of injection. The oral polio vaccine, which we no longer use in this country anymore, the one that used to be dropped on sugar cubes but more recently was just squirted into the mouth, I mean, that itself could cause polio. The oral polio vaccine would cause polio in about 6 to 8 children a year. That's why we don't use it anymore. You know, you have vaccines like the swine flu vaccine, which was used in this country in 1976, that caused a very rare kind of paralysis called Guillain-Barré syndrome. A rotavirus vaccine that was used in the late 1990s in this country was found to be a rare cause of intestinal blockage, which was picked up and made it so that vaccine was removed from the market. So I think, yeah, sure, I think anything that has an effect can have a side effect. Sometimes those side effects can be serious. But I think if you look certainly on balance, the benefits of vaccines clearly and definitively outweigh their risks for every individual child who chooses to get them.
Let's talk with some callers here. We have a couple here ready to go, and we'll start with a caller in Villa Grove, line number 2. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Well, thank you for your forum. I'm one of those parents who chooses not to vaccinate my kids until I am forced to, and there's a few reasons why. One reason is, you know, no, I don't trust the big pharmaceutical corporations because, you know, their whole point is to make millions of dollars, and most of the studies are funded by them. You know, there's a lot of reasons why I don't trust my government and the huge corporations. You know, sure, you know, of course they want everybody to get a vaccine. They make a lot of money off of that. And, you know, I don't necessarily agree. I mean, science is a way of describing the world. It's one way of describing the world. It's not the only way. And I appreciate modern medicine, but I also think that there's a lot of other things that we need to look at. And, you know, the same dose that you give a 3-month-old baby is the same dose that they give the kid when they're 5 years old. And I think that, you know, body weight has a lot to do with it. That's my understanding. You know, I don't think it's tested properly. And even if it's a 1-in-a-million effect, if your child is that 1-in-a-million, it's your child that is affected. You know, I mean, it's easy to look at statistics, but I'd rather look at individual cases. So, you know, I appreciate the science of vaccinations, but I don't think it's the big picture. And, you know, there's We're not irresponsible people. We're thinking people. That's why we choose not to.
Well,
I think that's part of it.
All right. Well, Dr. Offit, what you can respond any way that you like.
Sure. Well, there were a number of things that were brought up. I think that the notion that vaccines aren't tested or tested effectively is just incorrect. I mean, it wasn't said in the prelude, but I'm a co-inventor of a vaccine, the rotavirus vaccine, which is made by Merck and came out onto the market in 2006. So, I mean, we actually made those strains in our laboratory in the late 80s, and I then got to watch for the next 16 years the research of development, and I was pretty impressed. I mean, I think if you look at that vaccine was tested in 70,000 people pre-licensure for many years, and certainly the vaccines are tested at a level far greater in far greater numbers of children for longer periods of time than any drug. And
secondly, who funds the research?
Well, the only people that could fund it.
The large pharmaceutical.
I mean, you know, the phase 3 study that was done by Merck to test that vaccine involved 70,000 children in 12 countries over 4 years. That was a $350 million trial. Only the company, frankly, has the resources and expertise to do that kind of experiment. Then what they do is they submit their data to the Food and Drug Administration, who spends 10 months analyzing those data and makes sure that they meet all the rigid criteria to make sure that those vaccines don't contain adventitious agents, that the safety and efficacy is very carefully studied, and then and only then does a vaccine get licensed. Then it's reviewed by both the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the American Academy of Pediatrics, who again have expert advisory committees that go through all those data to make sure that the vaccine is safe and effective and should be recommended. I think it's actually a phenomenally workable infrastructure that has clearly saved the lives of children in our country.
I'm going to jump in here. I want to appreciate the comments of the caller. I've got a couple of other people I have here. I guess I'm wondering what you would say to someone who... Say we're talking about measles, for example, that we're concerned about the possibility of a bad outcome. Would it really be, and assuming that a lot of other people are having their kids inoculated, having their kids vaccinated against measles, so the chances of maybe if you yourself have not been, and if everybody else is, your chances of coming into contact measles are somewhat less. I mean, if you were trying to play the odds there and you were concerned about the possibility of the bad outcome, would you really be taking such a big risk by choosing not, say, as again, if we're talking about measles, choosing not to have your child vaccinated against measles?
Well, I think recent outbreaks answer that question. If you choose not to vaccinate your child and there are others in your community who are making a similar choice, it's possible to drop below a level of herd immunity that will be protective. Mm-hmm. Measles is a highly contagious disease, so much so that if there is a drop in herd immunity, it will quickly find it and spread through those communities. And now you have, you know, 127 children with measles, one of five of whom have been hospitalized. If it gets to a few hundred cases, there'll be measles deaths. And I just think in knowing that you have a vaccine that can safely protect against measles, why you would ever make that choice to put your child in that kind of position makes no sense.
All right, let's talk with someone else. This is someone on cell phone, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I grew up in an era when I had to be quarantined when my brother got measles. I still got measles. And then we had to be quarantined for chickenpox. I think I missed at least a month, maybe 6 weeks of school 1 year because of that. And it was to protect other people. We don't talk about that sort of thing. But I wanted to mention two things. One is I think that it's important too for adults to check on their what they need to do to update their shots. We're traveling abroad early this year, and I needed to get a few things updated because given how long ago I'd had various shots, I needed to have updates. And I think, too, that people forget that thinking about the whole pediatric as well as general public health, we have made most of our advances in reducing death, as I understand it, through public health initiatives such as vaccinations. We don't think about that We tend to be a culture that thinks you get sick and then you expect medicine to fix it. And medicine can't always fix it. It's much better to prevent it in the first place. And so those are my two comments. I got to go. Thanks.
All right. Well, again, Dr. Offit, you can comment on that any way you like.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's so rare, actually, when I do these shows that anybody calls in and says something good about vaccines, so I appreciate that. But I think the caller makes two important points. One is that it is far better to prevent something than to try and treat it after it's already occurred. And you know, I live in Philadelphia, so we're supposed to mention Ben Franklin's an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure at least once during every hour. But what percentage of our healthcare dollars spent on prevention? Probably less than 3%. Vaccines certainly suffer that. The other important point I think that the caller made is that adult vaccines are important. We tend to think of vaccines as just a kid's thing to do, but you know, adult vaccines like, you know, the human papillomavirus vaccine, which prevents cervical cancer, or the meningococcal vaccine now recommended for adolescents and young adults to prevent a very important bacterial cause of bloodstream infection and meningitis, the hepatitis B vaccine. I mean, adults should be, and obviously the diphtheria and tetanus and acellular pertussis vaccines are now recommended for adults, and it's something I think that not just adults who are seeking medical care, but even those who take care of adults aren't as good at.
We are at our midpoint, just slightly past. I have one more caller we'll get to just here in a moment. I'd like to introduce again our guest, Dr. Paul Offit. He is a pediatrician. His specialty is infectious disease medicine. He's also an internationally known expert on vaccines. He's professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania, where he's also chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He has written many scientific papers and also a number of books for general readers, including one entitled Vaccines, What You Should Know, published in 2003, and his most recent is titled Vaccinated, One Man's Quest to Defeat the World's Deadliest Diseases. This book was published in 2007 and profiles a man named Maurice Hillman, who was involved in the development of most of the vaccines that are available today, including those for measles, mumps, rubella, hepatitis A and B, Haemophilus influenza B, influenza, and some others. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next up is a caller on line 3 in Urbana. Hello? Hello, it's a caller there, line 3, Urbana?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
More and more with genetic mapping, they're discovering, you know, that you have a predisposition to this or that, and it seems to me that the studies that have been conducted wouldn't necessarily show up for kids. I guess I wonder why you would be discouraging parents from getting a sequential shot instead of the multiple in one shot, if they're willing to do that, and just stress how important it is to do it in a timely manner.
Right. Well, thanks for the call. I think that, first of all, when you choose to separate out or delay or withhold vaccines, you do increase the period of time during which children are susceptible to certain diseases. I mean, one of the reasons that we, for example, want children to be pretty much fully immune by 6 months of age against pneumococcus or against Haemophilus influenza type B is that's when you start to see those diseases. So when you choose to delay or space out vaccines, you put children at risk, and I would argue unnecessary risk. The concern that children are being overwhelmed by vaccines is just not based on sort of the biology or immunology of what we know about children and their immune responses. Again, as I said earlier, you know, what you typically encounter and manage every day from the environment is far greater than you're exposed to in vaccines. So it's a fear that's understandable. I'm just saying it's ill-founded.
All right. We'll go on again to another caller. This is Champagne in line 1. Hello.
Hi. I don't know if this will be are you familiar with the Gardasil?
Yes.
Okay. What are your comments on that? My daughter is going to be turning 15. Her mom's talking about taking her to get the vaccination. And how long has it been out on the market?
Right. So the Gardasil, which is a vaccine to prevent human papillomavirus, which is the only known cause of cervical cancer, came onto the market in June of 2006. Prior to that, it had been tested in roughly 30,000 women for about 5 years. So there's about 7 years of experience now in tens of thousands of women. The vaccine is made using a technology, so-called recombinant DNA technology, that's been around since the early 1980s with our manufacturer of the hepatitis B vaccine. It works. It's safe. I mean, it's just a purified protein vaccine. There's no reason to believe it would be anything other than safe. And it's a value. I mean, my daughter's 13 years old, and she has gotten her 3 doses of Gardasil vaccine because when she has sex, and this is obviously, she's actually not going to have sex. I think other people's children will be having sex. But in case she has sex, I mean, I know that she, you know, that she's protected against at least 70% of the strains that cause cervical cancer.
Okay, well, has there been any side effects of it or anything like that?
It's actually remarkably safe. I mean, as you would expect from a purified protein vaccine, I mean, there's been some sort of irresponsible media reports that it caused fainting or caused seizures or caused neurological deficits. But, you know, those reports suffer from the fact that, you know, any vaccine that you give to large numbers of adolescents, you know, the kinds of things that occur during adolescence anyway are still going to occur. The question is whether a vaccinated child is at greater risk than a child who hasn't gotten the vaccine. And all the data to date suggests it's probably one of our safest vaccines. So I think the data look great. And so the decision is really clear. Here you have a vaccine that you know has been tested in more than 30,000 women for 7 years. You know that it's going to protect against about 70% of the strains that cause cervical cancer, about 90% of the strains that cause anal or genital warts. And although it's horrible to think, at least for me anyway, you know, that your 13-year-old is ever going to be submitted to, exposed to any of that, it's going to happen. And so it's an easy choice to make. You know, there's so few things I think we can do as parents to actually put our children in a safer position that this is an easy decision.
Well, I'm in the vicarious situation. She doesn't live with me all the time. I'm divorced, so, you know, I'm just hearing it from her now. So I need to take it up with her mother, so I just wanted to talk to you since you just happened to be on the radio.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And now we'll go to somebody else here on the cell phone. This is on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I need to find out what is being done about all the people that are coming into this country from third world countries, south, like Mexico, Central America, South America, that haven't been inoculated for all these diseases. They're bringing it in. Is it true or false?
Right. What I can say is the interesting thing actually about these measles outbreaks that are occurring, and you know that were in California, New York, and 15 other states, is the source. It really all came in from outside of this country, but not from the places that you mentioned. Where it came from, which I think was surprising to a lot of people, most prominently was Switzerland, from Western Europe, from Israel. So, you know, places where you developed countries where you would have imagined it wouldn't have come from. It did in large part because of some of the problems that were mentioned earlier that I think are becoming growing problems here, just a general distrust of vaccines and I think a power of local anti-vaccine movements.
Well, it just seems like all these diseases, childhood diseases, have just started recently within the past, 5, 6, 7 years? I've been hearing about it on the radio.
Well, the childhood diseases have certainly been with us ever since kind of recorded history for the most part, but I think you're right. I think that the notion the kinds of vaccine preventable diseases that children can suffer have gotten a lot more attention over the last few years. I think in part because some people are worried about the vaccines to prevent them.
Okay.
All right. All right. Thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And again, our guest this morning is Dr. Paul Offit. He's a pediatrician. He's professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania and an internationally known expert on vaccines. And that's what we're talking about here this morning. Now that we have seen this expansion in the availability of vaccines, you said that in 1900, that's when we had the first one that was for smallpox, and that now we have about 14
Right. It.
Do you think that, and now, just recently now, we've had a couple of new ones, the one for the human papillomavirus and the one for meningococcus.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that we should expect, say, over, I don't know, in the next few decades, that the number of available vaccines and those that are recommended are going to increase? Is there anything that you say right now you're thinking it would be great if we had a vaccine for X?
Yeah, well, I guess I'll surprise you with this answer. I think we've seen sort of a flurry of vaccine activity in the 1960s we did. It's not so much in the 70s, and then in the 80s, and then the 90s and the early part of this decade. You know, we've gone from really a handful of vaccines now to 14 vaccines. I don't see another new vaccine actually in the next decade. But the answer to your question, is there anything I would like to see a vaccine for? It's respiratory syncytial virus. I mean, this is a virus that causes hundreds of thousands of children to be hospitalized, causes thousands of deaths every year. I mean, it causes pneumonia and general respiratory tract infections, and would be a tremendous value. It's been hard to make that vaccine. That's why you don't see it.
Mm. There are questions here. Line one next, Champagne. Hello.
I have a question on the young children, 12, 13, 14, in our public schools. You mentioned earlier about the herpes, not genital herpes, but they're getting herpes transmitted through drinking out of someone's cup or through the somehow getting into the bloodstream. Now it's passed on to the family, the parents, and the kids have had vaccinations because you have to when you go into the public school system, but they're still conducting the herpes and passing it through other children. Is that true?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to. Certainly, if you're referring to herpes simplex virus, I mean, the kind that you see, you know, that's a genital infection or an infection sometimes in the mouth,
yes,
there is not a vaccine for that.
Okay, that's where we're getting it. You got the cold sores come up, it's inside the mouth, and then, you know, it passes through other people that away. Okay.
Yeah, there's not, people are working on a vaccine. The preliminary data look mildly promising, but I don't think that's going to be a vaccine for the next 10 years.
Is there anything to do, though, when that's contracted? What do we do to combat that? They've given antibiotics, but from my understanding, once it's in the system, there's no way to get it out of the system. Is that a true statement?
That's true. It's true of all herpes viruses, actually. Once an Epstein-Barr virus, the virus that causes mono, chickenpox virus, the varicella virus, those are all herpes viruses. And you're absolutely right that when you get infected with those, they tend to live latently in the body, in the nervous system, in the case of chickenpox. And they can sort of reactivate at times. And I think that's one of the difficulties with those viruses. Again, it's why the best thing to do is to try and prevent them.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
And to line number two, Urbana.
Oh, hi, how are
yes?
you?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the people that call in reference to not wanting to vaccinate their children and stuff, I suggest they go live in a lesser developed country for a few years and watch children and young adults drop like flies from diseases that are virtually unheard of in this culture, in the West and in modernized cultures. And then they'll come back with a better appreciation of how a country like ours or the West has pretty much eliminated a lot of these diseases. So they're picking and choosing or a little naive. But I have a friend who had a child when he was older, and his daughter must have been his vaccination for DPT must have worn off because he contracted a really serious cold, and nobody could figure out what it was. And it turned out that he was exposed to whooping cough. And as an adult, I mean later, like in his late 40s, and became extraordinarily ill. Neurologically, it's really affected him. So do you have any suggestions for people that are older that have children so they'd be revaccinated for this? Because I understand the vaccines wear off after a while.
Yeah, that's a great – there's actually – you made two really good points. I'll take the second one first. It's absolutely correct that certain vaccines like diphtheria or tetanus or pertussis can have waning immunity. It's not true with most vaccines, but it's definitely true with those three. And it used to be that, you know, that we would then recommend that adults get re-immunized with diphtheria and tetanus, but we never asked them to be re-immunized with whooping cough, the pertussis component, because it just was too reactogenic. It just caused too many local side effects, and we weren't able to make a vaccine that could do that. Now, recently that did happen. It's called Tdap. And so now adults are recommended to get a vaccine that has both the tetanus, M. diphtheria, and pertussis components in it to address the issue of waning immunity. You're right. I mean, you can be fully vaccinated against pertussis as a child and then get a very serious case of pertussis as an adult. We just didn't have a good vaccine for that. Now we do. So that's good news.
Yeah.
The second point that you made, and I think it's a great one, is do we take vaccines for granted in this country? Absolutely. I mean, my parents, you know, who are now in their 80s, there was never a hard sell for them to vaccinate me or my brother or sister because they saw what these diseases could do and saw that it could cause hospitalization and death. And I, too, grew up, you know, with these diseases. I mean, I was born before 1957, so I mean, I had measles and had mumps and had German measles. I mean, I had the full cadre of infectious diseases. And so I appreciate them. But young mothers today don't appreciate them because they don't see them. So I think seeing them would certainly give them a sense of appreciation. Hopefully the way that they see them won't be the way that we're currently seeing them now, which is, you know, outbreaks of measles. I mean, I just hope that we don't have to learn the lesson the hard way, that we have to actually see these diseases to be scared by them again.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And I've heard this before, and I've listened to David Inch's program before. And people, but, you know, if you have someone like you on, there's always the hard sell people who act like it's a corporate conspiracy, and I may be, you know, it's a monetary gain or whatever, but I think that the intent is genuine, because I've been in third world countries, I've been in Asia and all this stuff, and I've seen these people. I mean, all you have to do is go to a graveyard in the United States and go back prior to 1950, 40s, and look at how many people died before they were 13 or 14 years old, count the numbers of dead children, and most likely they just died of a disease that was preventable later by vaccines. I just want to impress that. Thank you. I really appreciate your work.
All right. Well,
thank you very much.
Thank you. Can I just address one thing you said at the end there, because I think it's important, is you're right. I mean, we certainly, it's very easy to vilify pharmaceutical companies, and I think pharmaceutical companies have acted occasionally, you know, aggressively or unethically or even, frankly, illegally. I don't see that on the vaccine side. I don't. I think probably because they're just not big money makers. I mean, drugs, you know, which you can take every day, like lipid-lowering agents or obesity products or neurological agents or diabetes products, I mean, that's different than vaccines, which you're going to take once or a few times in your lifetime. As a result, these are not big products. They're not. I mean, the rotavirus vaccine is about a $500 million a year product. I mean, that's not exactly a blockbuster. You know, if you look at drugs like Lipitor, which is a $13 billion on its way to being an $18 billion a year product, and that's just one cholesterol-lowering agent. Vaccines are kind of the backwater in many ways of these pharmaceutical companies. And it's always hard to get them interested in making them. And that, you know, in 1955, we had 27 companies that made vaccines. You know, today we have 5 that make them for American children. It's just not a very good business. So it's always funny to me to watch people say how it's, you know, it's just big business. It's really not that big of a business.
This is something I know you've written about, and I'm glad we've gotten to it, because it was a point I wanted to make sure that we would get to, and that was this issue that because vaccines are expensive to make and to develop, and they're not a big moneymaker, that, as you say, the number of pharmaceutical companies making vaccines has actually declined. Do you worry, or do doctors worry, that in fact we might not have enough vaccine, or we wouldn't have enough companies that were interested in making it?
Well, I think there's the good news and the bad news. I'll start with the bad news first. The bad news is that whenever you see any sort of manufacturing hiccup, I mean, and Haemophilus influenza B vaccine was that, the chickenpox vaccine was that, both made by Merck, and when you saw sort of that they were having manufacturing problems, there were instantly shortages. You know, and that wouldn't happen for a cholesterol-lowering agent or a potency product or a hair loss product. I mean, if any of those companies, and there are many companies that make them, you know, had a problem, you know, believe me, we have enough to, you know, to give potency products to the entire world many times over. That's not a problem. But with vaccines, just even slight variations in manufacturing that are problems are instantly you feel the reverberation, because for many vaccines, only one company makes that vaccine. You know, on the other hand, I think vaccines were at an all-time low, frankly, in the late 1990s. I mean, associated with these concerns about thimerosal, you know, and the rotavirus vaccine had just been taken off the market. There was real dispiritedness, I think, among vaccine makers. But the pneumococcal vaccine, which came out in 2000, you know, became a billion-dollar-a-year product, which is modest, frankly, from pharmaceutical companies, but at least it wasn't ridiculously low. And I think it got companies sort of in. The HPV vaccine, I think, has been a successful vaccine for Merck, will be for GSK. And I think, although they're never going to be big revenue generators, they're at least good enough that I think companies aren't going to completely abandon vaccines. But I think we will always suffer the fact that only one or a couple companies will make an individual vaccine.
All right, let's talk with someone next in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Hello. Yes. I am wondering if you could tell me what can cause a young child to have a stomach with no good bacteria, and what is the process to add the good bacteria?
Right, so that's not really a vaccine question, but what I would say is, actually, the stomach's probably not exactly the right word. Your stomach is actually sterile. It makes enough in the way of acid that the stomach itself doesn't have bacteria in it. But you're right, certainly right after the stomach, you know, the first part of the small intestine, the so-called duodenum, does have bacteria, and you know, hopefully it's in bacteria are actually there to help us digest our food. Sometimes when that bacterial flora is altered by antibiotics or antifungal agents, it can be put in you can select for the kinds of bacteria or fungi that don't help us digest our food, and that's a problem that, you know, you should work out with your doctor in terms of how that can be altered.
Thank you.
All sure. Right, let's go to Savoy. This is another caller here, line one. Hello.
Hi, I have. Well, to start off, I did vaccinate my child. I mean, I did it with, you know, some reservation, but I do believe in the vaccination program. My question was specifically about the hepatitis B vaccine. You know, they're given this within hours of being born. And I, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought hepatitis B was a sexually transmitted disease. And I just wondered what the rationale was behind inoculating against that specific disease so early on. I mean, they do it in the nursery. Thank you.
Right.
Yeah, sure. Great question. That's a very commonly asked question. So in 1991, we recommended that hepatitis B vaccine be given routinely to infants, including a first dose being given within, you know, a day of birth. The reason for that, I'll explain why the day, and then I'll explain the issue of, you know, whether babies need to be vaccinated at all, given its transmission. The problem with hepatitis B is that if a mother has hepatitis B and the baby is born to a mother who has hepatitis B, therefore is passing through a birth canal that has blood in it that's contaminated with hepatitis B, if you get hepatitis B at birth, your chances of going on to have chronic disease, meaning either cirrhosis or liver cancer, is about 90%. I mean, it's really high. So if you don't get that vaccine, then you're in trouble. And frankly, all you need is the vaccine. There's excellent studies out of India showing even just a single shot of vaccine then will be protective. Now, some would argue, well, we test mothers in the first trimester, and so if the mother's hepatitis doesn't have hepatitis, why worry? The answer is twofold. One, because no test is perfect, and two, because people can acquire hepatitis B and not even know it after they've gotten the test. So given the consequences of not or of getting infection in that at birth, that's hence the birth dose. Now, the question of transmission is a commonly asked one. If you look pre-vaccine, there were in this country 16,000 children less than 10 years of age who got hepatitis B from what's called person-to-person non-sexual contact. Toothbrushes, you know, sharing things like washcloths, et cetera, can you know, saliva from, you know, kiss from Uncle Bob who doesn't know he has hepatitis B. I mean, those are ways in which a child can get hepatitis B. And that what's not sexual transmission, it's not, you know, use of drugs, it's just relatively casual non-sexual contact. And so for that reason, because 16,000 children a year suffered that, we recommended that children be vaccinated. And it's been remarkably effective.
Well, thank you so much. That explains a lot.
All right. Well, thank you. Somebody wants to dial real quick here. We can probably get in a question, at least one. We have a couple of minutes left, and we'll continue, of course, to talk with our guest, Dr. Paul Offit. We talked about, I guess a little earlier, I asked about whether you thought there would be an expansion in the total number of vaccines, and you said, well, you weren't really sure that after that, the big boom in the development of vaccines, maybe we'll see some more. And certainly we have now seen some new ones and ones that are recommended for adults. We have vaccine for pneumonia. We have for shingles. Now, as you say, there's this recommendation that that adults, when they get their tetanus booster every 10 years, like they're supposed to, they're also supposed to get a booster for whooping cough. Not only because you don't want them to get it, but because you don't want them to be a reservoir of whooping cough that they might then pass on to kids. In addition to that, we now have the one for the human papillomavirus that a lot of people believe would really address the problem of cervical cancer. Do you think that we would be seeing more, and I know you're a pediatrician, but that you would be seeing more vaccines recommended for adults?
Yes. I mean, I think you're actually seeing that much, as you said. In addition, I mean, the pneumococcal vaccine now is we're sort of moving that more into adults. The influenza vaccine, even for, you know, I think there's going to be a universal recommendation for influenza vaccine in the next 2 years where everybody's recommended to get the vaccine every year. So, yes, and there's been a push by the American Medical Association and others to really try and get adult immunization much more on the front burner so people see what these diseases can do. I mean, if you look at the diseases that cause hospitalization and death in this country, I mean the largest percentage are those that occur in adults, hepatitis B being one example. So yes, I do think that adult immunizations are going to becoming more and more important.
See, we have one more question here. Someone in Rossville, it's line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I'll be very quick. When do you foresee us being able to stop having to immunize children for polio, since it's not anything that's currently in the United States? And many times, especially with the addition of new vaccines for that preschooler kindergartner who now is getting 4 or 5, it would be nice to drop that one injectable polio if it could be done. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a great question. There's actually only been one vaccine that's been decertified because the disease was eliminated from the face of the earth, and that was smallpox. But that's the point. I mean, the fact is polio hasn't been eliminated from the earth, and because international travel is common, there is no doubt that polio walks into this country every year. I mean, in the face of someone who doesn't know that they're excreting that virus. So I think if we stopped giving the polio vaccine and our immunization rates, you know, dropped over the next couple decades to zero, knowing that polio still occurs in the world, I think would put us at risk, a risk that's not acceptable. So I do think for that reason, the benefits to the vaccine still clearly outweigh its risk. I think there's certainly been a tremendous global effort to eliminate polio, and if we can do that, I think then you can argue we could eliminate the polio vaccine. But I think that bioterrorism has kind of changed the map a little bit on that, because even though we haven't given smallpox vaccine routinely since 1972, when we invaded Iraq, as you remember, there was a tremendous interest in vaccinating at least the frontline responders in our population with smallpox vaccine because of fears that it could be used as a bioterrorist agent, and that's kind of changed the face of things a little bit, the fear of bioterrorism.
Well, there, I think that we'll have to finish with our thanks to our guest, Paul Offit. He's a pediatrician. He's professor of pediatrics at University of Pennsylvania, where he's also chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He specializes in infectious disease medicine and is a well-known expert on vaccines. He's authored a number of books, including Vaccines, What You Should Know, and most recently, Vaccinated, One Man's Quest to Defeat the World's Deadliest Diseases. And Dr. Offit, thanks very much.
Thank you, David.